it's very interesting. A lot of people who kind of go through the financial education or personal development side, they read a book or, you know, they have a mentor, but to kind of go through it from the rougher side of it, that you're in a bad place and you kind of have to remake yourself. What a wonderful story of, you know, turning it around and now helping other people do just that.
This is the Saskatchewan Real Estate Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Saskatchewan Real Estate Podcast, your home for all things Saskatchewan, all things real estate. And today we're mixing in a little financial advice as well. Super happy to have Jordan Farr come on the podcast and share a little bit of her wisdom. Jordan, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very excited.
Start off with a little introduction of yourself and just a little bit about what you do.
Okay. So I'm a CPA. I did my Bachelor of Commerce and my Master's in Accounting at the U of S. Here in Saskatoon. I currently work as a manager in the finance department at the Saskatoon Police Service. I've had kind of a whole schwack of different jobs over the last few years, which have been really interesting. And I've learned a lot about different aspects of finance and the things that I'm interested in. And that's kind of what's got me into real estate and personal finance and stuff like that. In my time outside of work, I do spend a lot of time doing real estate stuff. I own a few different properties with my partner. I self-manage them. And I also post a lot about personal finance, mostly just education and giving some advice and stuff here and there. I also really like traveling. My partner and I are going to Japan this fall. We're very excited about that. Yeah, we just booked tickets. And we have a corgi and a cat. So that's a little bit like short snippet about myself. Yeah.
Wonderful. So many awesome things mixed within there that I think a lot of people who enjoy real estate probably really, you know, have a lot of things in common with you. You know, you love the travel, you love the aspect, and you love, you know, making yourself more financially educated. And just walk us through, Jordan, when did that start for you? Were you 10 years old and you had a piggy bank and you knew exactly how much money you were going to put in there? And what was the path for you starting on kind of this path to financial education and becoming more well-versed in it?
Yeah, no, quite the opposite, actually. I was like pretty bad with money up until like my mid-20s. Growing up, we didn't talk about money like ever. And if we did, it was kind of like misconstrued. Like my dad used to joke that he made $22 a day and like never actually shared like how much he actually made. So I feel like my perception of like the cost of living and like money in general was kind of skewed. And I was really privileged to have a lot of help from my parents. Like they paid for most of my education and a lot of my bills and stuff and helped me out up until like kind of my mid-20s when I was finished school. And because of that, when I started having to pay for all my own bills and stuff, I just didn't really have a good concept of like income versus expenses and like how it all flushes out. And I worked a lot all throughout like university. And even I started working when I was like 14. So I've had a job forever, but I never really had any like real expenses. So I kind of got into like bad shopping habits and kind of worked myself into like a pretty bad hole. I actually got myself in like $60,000 of like consumer debt, and that was like not even student. So I was like really not great at finances actually until like my mid-20s. And that was even while I was going through school as a CPA, which I think people are surprised about too. But just because you learn about business finances and accounting doesn't mean you actually know a lot about personal finances, investing and proper saving and debt and stuff like that. So it wasn't until it was kind of like around the pandemic, the start of the pandemic, where I was in a lot of debt and I was like, okay, something's got to give. And I think I got myself into all this debt thinking like, oh, I have this fancy big like salary now as like a CPA. It's the most money I'd ever been making, obviously, as a student prior. And I was like, oh, I can just up my lifestyle. Like the lifestyle creep kind of sets in. But what I didn't realize was like, I had taken on some debt while I was doing my master's degree, and I just kind of let it keep compounding. And I hadn't really taken into consideration the compound interest working against me. So all of a sudden, what I thought was going to take like no time at all to pay off really quickly was looking like it was going to take a lot longer. And so when I kind of realized that and I was like, okay, whoa, like something's got to stop here. I just kind of had a mindset flip and I was like, I honestly felt like I was kind of drowning financially at that point. And then like my parents didn't know, I hadn't really told anybody. And on the outside, it looked like I was like successful and like had all these nice clothes and a nice apartment and all this new furniture. And I, you know, and inside it was like, nope, things aren't great. So I kind of had a turning point during the beginning of the pandemic where I ended up coming clean to my parents, and they were super supportive and like non-judgmental. And honestly, that was like the biggest blessing. And they were just like, okay, well, like you need to like turn this around. And so I was like, okay, I need to make some changes. So I ended up getting a different job. I really didn't like the job that I was in before. And I think a lot of that, like not being happy with where I was in life, was also leading to like overspending and overcompensating in other ways. So I ended up getting a different job that was quite a large salary increase. I ended up moving to downsize and like reduce my living costs. And I just started to make a plan, and I started to put basically like every amount of extra money that I had towards this debt. And I got like really kind of obsessive over it, and I almost like gamified it. And that's around the time I started like learning a lot about personal finance in general. I discovered like podcasts and people on Instagram, and I discovered Bigger Pockets, like the real estate podcast. And I kind of just like dove deep into it. And that was kind of the start of like the personal finance journey. Around that same time, I had been like living in a couple of rental properties that I had young female landlords, and something in my brain was like, huh, that's interesting. And I started kind of running numbers and like looking at like the cost of the properties that I was living in versus like what they were charging me rent. And I was like, they're making quite a bit of money off of me, and they're like young females, so like, why can't I do that? And so, yeah, that's kind of like the segue into it. And then I just kind of like obsessed over it for like, well, the last like 5 years. And I've since gotten myself out of the $60,000 worth of debt. I've like increased my investments. I've, you know, learned how to budget and actually track my goals and stuff like that. And now I feel like fairly passionate about like helping other people and spreading the word and showing that like even people that have privilege and have had help don't necessarily know how to manage their money. And money's complicated, and personal finances are so personal, and it's different for every single person. And I just want to share like, I guess, education and some advice about like, it's okay if you don't know what you're doing. Like, we're not taught this stuff in school. They don't teach about it even in university. Unless you take like a personal finance course, you still don't learn about investments. Like, I didn't know about investing until I was like maybe 25, and I learned it from people on the internet. So yeah, that's kind of like, I could talk forever about it, but that's kind of like a short-ish version of how I got interested in personal finance.
Thank you for being so honest about that, Jordan. I think a lot of times when we see something online, if we like looked at your Instagram per se, you would appear to be a very successful young lady. You got it all together, but what a wonderful backstory of that must have been really hard at that time, being in that much debt. And really probably feeling like, geez, I'm just kind of treading water here, and I don't really have a path forward. And it's very interesting. A lot of people who kind of go through the financial education or personal development side, they read a book or, you know, they have a mentor. But to kind of go through it from the rougher side of it, that you're in a bad place and you kind of have to remake yourself. What a wonderful story of, you know, turning it around and now helping other people do just that. So just give us an overview that, like, was there just a moment you're like, I just can't live like this anymore? Was it literally just, what was it in yourself, or was there anything else that kind of outside influenced you at that time?
It was more in like myself. I think I got to a point where like my student line of credit was fully maxed, and my credit card, I think, was maxed at that point. And the like monthly interest, I think it was like I was paying up to like $400 a month in interest alone, which like wasn't enough for me to like pay down the debt. Like, I was getting to the point where I like literally couldn't afford to keep paying like the debt and my regular expenses. And I had a habit of shopping, and so it was like, you literally can't keep shopping and buying things because you no longer can afford like your monthly payments. So I was like, I have to stop. Like, I have to like snap out of this and like start getting myself out of the situation. And luckily, the job that I had switched to was like a $30,000 increase between like benefits, and I had like a work from home allowance, and including the RSP matching, because I didn't have that at my prior job. And he was in the financial space as well, and so I was doing accounting for him, but he was like a financial planner. And so I came clean to him as well, because we were going to set up my RSP match, and he needs to like my net worth and stuff like that. And so it was like, yeah, I'm in a lot of debt, and we talked about it, and he was actually really supportive of letting me take my RSP match and put it towards my high interest debt instead of investing it. So that was really helpful. And that's the thing too, is like, once you start you know, opening up about and not hiding and being shameful of like the situation you're in, like people are supportive and honestly like want to help. And that's kind of the time when I started to like find other people on journeys of debt payoff. Like there's so many people on Instagram and YouTube and social media openly sharing like where they're at. And I feel like for such a time, I had so much shame around like, I have this lifestyle that I'm in this bit, like, you know, like I was a new CPA. I wanted to appear successful. I wanted to appear like I, and it was like, when I started thinking about like, why, it was like, why do I need to like have this vision or this like appearance like externally when like it doesn't feel good internally? And like, what was I doing it for? So I kind of just became like a lot more self-reflective and had to like ask myself hard questions. And when I got more clear on like what I actually valued and what was really important to me and what was going to make me happy in the long term, it was like, this path isn't it. So.
Well, hats off to you again. It sounds like you've done a wonderful job, and now you're doing such a great job helping other people with educational content. As I mentioned, that's kind of how I stumbled across you. And what made me reach out to get you on the podcast was one particular post was the seven things you could do to help yourself retire early. And I thought a lot of them were really practical advice that really anyone at any stage could kind of say, this is something to aim for, or if you're currently in a place to get these going right away. So let's start with it, Jordan. The seven things, what's first on the list?
Yeah. First, I actually want to back up a little bit and give some context around like the retiring early part, because not everyone maybe has heard of like financial independence, retire early, or FIRE. But that was a big, because like, I don't know if I'd mentioned, but I don't like love accounting. I've kind of figured that out since like I was in school, and I just felt like, well, you started down this path, you have to finish it now. And I've tried a few different jobs, like I'd mentioned, and like nothing's been like, wow, I love this so much. And so when I heard about financial independence, retire early, I was like, oh, like there's a way to like be financially independent. I don't necessarily want to retire early. I just want to do things that are I'm more passionate about. And some of those things may not pay as high as like an accounting career. So the fact that you can like be financially independent, but long before retirement, like your traditional 65, was like, interesting. Okay, how? So I'm sure you've heard of FIRE. But there's
a really great group in Saskatoon actually called FIRE. And I'm sure, I think you're, are you part of the Facebook group, Jordan?
They have in person and
online events, but really great. Yeah. Michael Ernick, who's a past guest on the podcast, helps to organize it. But yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful group.
Yeah. So did you know that there's like a lot of different types of FIRE?
Oh yeah.
Like there's so many different types. So you can kind of customize FIRE to whatever your life is and whatever your goals are. But once I figured out like, okay, this thing called FIRE, what are my goals? So for me, like I think the whole like barista FIRE thing is appealing because it's basically like having enough invested that your investments will continue to grow to cover your retirement, but then you can also either take some of your investments and live off them to subsidize your current life. Or for me, I'm making enough that like most of my extra income is going to investments right now. So once my investments are good and they can grow and I don't need to continue contributing to them, or like at least not as much, I can then downsize or downgrade my job to something that like isn't making 100 grand a year. Maybe it's something that's like paying 40 grand a year or 50 grand a year, or maybe it's something that's part-time, or maybe I can start a business and not be stressed about like having no income for the first couple of years, you know? So that to me is why like FIRE is really interesting to me. And these seven steps are kind of the way I figured out that like, and I've done the math. I've kind of figured out like I have about 54 grand invested right now. And if I were to invest $2,500 a month, which is steep, that's like an aggressive goal. But I also have a couple properties as well. So I'm factoring all those things in. Probably within the next 15 years, I can retire with over $1 million. So we'll see if we actually get there. But it's something that's motivating me. And like I said, I kind of like to gamify my financial goals and kind of have something to like look forward to. And it makes it more fun to save and to see the progress along the way. So back to the seven things. So the first one is aggressively paying down debt. So I kind of talked about that. I was in a lot of debt and I kind of just like honed in really aggressively on paying it down and getting out of it as fast. Once I kind of switched my mind and found out about this financial independence, and I was like, oh, I don't have to work in accounting my whole life until I'm 65. Like, I want to expedite that. I want to like get out of this debt. so that I can start investing and I can start working towards being financially independent and having more choices and options in my life. And so, yeah, like I said, I switched jobs, got a big increase. My boss let me put my extra RSP match towards the debt to get out of it even faster. I kind of gamified it. So I started tracking it. I shared it on social media. That was around the time that I started my Aligned Finances page. And I started sharing my debt pay down journey, like with a bunch of other people that were also sharing their debt pay down journey. So it was kind of fun to have like a community, like rooting each other on and like sharing our wins and stuff. And then, yeah, also just to have like little small rewards and stuff in there. When you hit a certain goal, you pay off a certain amount to remember to like celebrate and like enjoy the process as well. So, that was kind of like the first big one. Also, like when I realized that like high interest, like some of those loans were like over 7%, was compounding against me. Like I said, I was paying like $400 a month in interest that I hadn't clued into when I took those loans out. Because again, the banks don't sit down and explain to you how this is going to work. They're just like, oh, take this $40,000 line of credit. Yeah, no problem. Oh, you wanted 30? Here's 40. And nobody sits down and explains to you like how much interest, if you max that out, you're going to be paying per month. And a lot of like students are like, oh, I got this big pay raise. Like I was making 65 grand, I think, at the time, which was pretty good for a new grad, but it's not like crazy amounts of money. And you don't factor that $400 a month payment into your budget when you're, you know, doing your budgeting. So that was kind of like the first one, was paying down debt and getting out of debt. The next one was maxing out my TFSA. So TFSA versus RSP, there's a lot of like discussion around which one you should do. They're both great. Honestly, you can't really go wrong. Like in the end, the taxes kind of even out to be the same. I've done the math and I've seen a couple other people post about it that have also done the math. It's more so like I guess like which one makes more sense for you. So TFSAs are a lot more flexible. You can take the money out with no consequences at any time. So that's not necessarily a good thing, because TFSAs, the best benefit from them is when you put your money in and allow them to grow like longer term. The most benefit is like the tax-free growth. So the longer your money sits in that account and grows, the bigger the gains are in the longer term. And so it's flexible, which is good, but it's also like the most you're going to benefit is if you leave your money in that account and invest it. RSPs, so that's another one. The third is to contribute to RSP to reduce your taxable income. So now that I'm at $100,000, I think the Saskatchewan for 2024 is around $111,000. And then you go from the 20% tax bracket to like the 26% tax bracket. So if you're below 100 grand, still fine to use your RSP, but you're not going to get the same like tax benefits from it as if you're in a higher tax bracket. So, for example, my partner is above the 111,000. So we're planning to put about like 20 grand into his RSP to lower him down into that 20% tax bracket again. And then the real benefits there is if you're in a higher bracket now than you think you will be in retirement, you are essentially saving the taxes there, but you still have to pay them in the future. So I'm trying to kind of strategize which account makes the most sense for me at which stage.
I could hop in a little bit on that one too. Some of that might also be like planning around buying a home. If someone is thinking about potentially using something like the RRSP home buyers plan, it might make more sense to contribute the money to the RRSP plan to be able to withdraw it for the purchase of the first home, if you're not also utilizing things like the first home savings account.
Yeah.
But yeah, really great points on that. What's next on the list, Jordan?
Yeah, just to add to that, I would say like, yeah, if you're planning on buying a home, the FHSA is actually like, go do that one, because
even if you, so much better.
Well, it's like, it's the same. You get the benefits of the RSP and the TFSA. So it's like a tax deduction when you put the money in, but it's also tax-free when you take it out. So like no brainer. And the nice thing about the FHSA is you can roll it into an RSP if you decide not to buy a house. So there's really no downside. Just make sure that you aren't currently a homeowner or haven't owned a home with your spouse or whatever in the last 4 years, because otherwise you don't qualify for it. Yeah, it's too bad. I own a house already, so I can't take advantage of that one, but it's a really awesome account for anybody who wants to buy a house in the next few years. The next one was just hold ETFs and investments for the long term. So like your TFSA and your RSP are the accounts. And then once you decide which account you're going to put your money into, you want to actually buy investments. So index funds in Canada are kind of like the umbrella. So ETFs and then mutual funds fall under index funds. Mutual funds, I wouldn't recommend. You have to buy them through like a financial advisor, and they have a lot higher fees than ETFs, which a 2% fee, it doesn't sound big, but it can add up to be like hundreds of thousands of dollars over like the lifetime of your investments. Like there's a calculator online if you wanted to. I forget where it is. I can find you the link, but you can actually like calculate. I think it's on Get Smart About Money. You can calculate the fees and like over the lifetime, I forget the numbers, but my partner and I were looking at them the other day and it was like, I think it was maybe like a $2 million portfolio in like 30 years, you would pay like $700,000 in fees with a 2%. Wow. Yeah, it's crazy. It sounds small, but it's not. So like a 1%, even like a 0.5% fee difference adds up huge over 30 years. Because again, it's money that you pay each year that if had it been left in your account will compound and grow and over like 30 years, right? So it ends up being a lot. So ETFs, exchange traded funds, are just like a small basket, or like, sorry, a big basket of like a lot of like different little like snippets of different stocks. So instead of just buying like one stock, like Apple, if you buy an ETF, you can like, for example, there's one ETF that's VFV in Canada, so the Toronto Stock Exchange, and it tracks the S&P 500. So you can own a snippet or a little piece of the top 500 stocks or top 500 companies in the US just by buying one ETF or one share or one piece of that ETF. So they're more diversified, which lowers your risk. They're cheaper in terms of fees, and you can literally just buy them through like an app on Questrade or Wealthsimple, or even a lot of banks have good trading platforms nowadays. So that's my strategy, is to just buy and hold ETFs for the long term and like to not worry when the market fluctuates, because it's going to roller coaster. That's how it always happens. But in the long term, it always trends upwards. So that is number four.
What are we looking at? Actually, before, I always kind of wonder about this too. Instead of just trying to like hit the lucky strike of picking like, oh, I know this stock is going to rock it up, just give us a broad overview of why, as we'll say, beginning investors or people who aren't even like focusing on this every day, why an ETF might be more advantageous than trying to pick single stocks.
Yeah, I would never recommend picking single stocks. If you like want to deep dive into like researching specific companies and looking at their financials and their projections and stuff, like go for it. But for somebody who's just like beginner starting out and like doesn't know where to put their money, like an ETF is a lot safer because it diversifies your risk. So instead of picking like just Apple and having all of your money in Apple, and then say Apple crashes for some reason and like goes bankrupt and you lose all of your money because that one company, you're riding on everything in that one company, you now have a little tiny piece of 500 companies, including Apple and Amazon and Tesla and all the other ones. And if one company, so Apple, goes bankrupt, well, the other 499 likely didn't. So your investment, if you have like $1,000 in an ETF versus $1,000 in just Apple, is going to be way less volatile than if you just owned one stock. So it's easier. It diversifies your risk. And ETFs are good because like you can buy some that like have, ideally you kind of want a broad market ETF. So you want like S&P 500 is a really good one. People like that, but also like the total US stock market's good. The total Canadian stock market's good. The total, like there's global or international ones as well. There's REITs, so real estate investment trust. There's a lot of different ways that you can kind of buy one ETF that has holdings in all of those things. So it's just, it reduces that's your risk. They aren't going to necessarily grow at the same rate that just buying Apple is, but they also won't decrease or decline at the rate that it also could if you just had one stock. Does that make sense? Awesome. So this has been this one's been huge. My first property that I bought, my parents helped me with the down payment because I was in a lot of debt. It was a condo, and I didn't want to buy a condo. I wanted to buy a house with basement suite because I had, like I said, realized that these young women landlords own these properties and are making money. And my parents were like, you can't own a house by yourself. Like, that's way too much to take on. So they were like, we'll only help you if we buy a condo. So we bought a condo. And then shortly after that, I met a guy. He was moving in because he worked a seasonal job and there was not enough space for us. And so his parents were like, hey, we'll help him with the down payment for his first property. And he was lower income, so he wouldn't really qualify to buy a place on his own. So combined, it made sense for us to buy one together. Wouldn't recommend that. Didn't turn out good. Don't buy properties with people you haven't been in a relationship with very long. And if you do, make sure you have an agreement ahead of time, because that didn't go super great. In the end, I did keep the house. I paid him out for it. It's all good. But it did get a little messy there for a minute. But anyway, so we ended up buying a property because I was like, hey, real estate, like I want a house hack, I want to be a landlord, whatever. So we ended up buying a house with a basement suite in it. And I was paying, I think, $1,300 a month to own my condo, which I still own. I rent it out. It breaks even. I don't make any like cash on it. It's just $1,300 is what I get paid, and that's what it costs. The house, though, however, I think when I rented the basement suite out, we only had $800 between the two of us left to pay for the cost of the house. So, again, I bought this house in the pandemic. The interest rates were like 2% or less. And the market was just different. So like, I think the house was originally listed for like 300,000 and I got it for like 254. So, and it was ugly. Like we did a lot of renovations to it and it put a lot of like DIY and time into it. But yeah, we ended up like, I took my rent from $1,300 or my cost of my mortgage or whatever in my condo from $1,300 down to 800. And then we split it two ways. So it was $400. So if I know not, it's not appealing to everybody to like share a space with a tenant. But honestly, like it was kind of just like living in our own apartment. We had a two bedroom suite or like space upstairs, plus an entire backyard and a garage, which was better than what I had at my condo. And the tenant lived in the basement. Like it wasn't that big of a deal, but the amount of savings that we had, like the tenant was paying me $1,300 a month as well. So to have that extra income helping cover bills, like that also helped me get out of debt a lot faster because I had extra income like now available to put towards the debt. So we've kind of done that ever since. We just moved out of, so I wasn't with him anymore. I'm with somebody else I've been with for a couple of years now. And we were living at that same house for a little while. Rents have gone up a lot. So I've increased the basement suite rent to like $1,500 a month. And then he had money for a down payment. So he bought the house that we're in right now. We just moved in here 2 months ago. He bought it like a year and a half ago though. And we rented it out for the year before that, did some renovations on the basement suite and stuff like that. And then, we just finally moved out of my place. So it's like a full on rental now and it's making $3,675 a month. And my costs are $2,100 a month. So it's cash flowing quite well now. So that's actually number six, is to invest in cash flowing properties. So that started as a house hack and it's since turned into a cash flowing rental property. And now the house that we're currently in that my partner owns is also a house hack. So we have a basement suite in the basement. She's paying us $1,300 and we live in the upstairs. So it's cut our living costs in half now. So yeah, I love real estate. I think it doesn't make sense in every scenario. You have to definitely run the numbers. I have a spreadsheet that I use and I plunk every house that I see that has a basement suite. I'm like, do the numbers make sense? You plunk in like the costs of everything per month, the rental income that you can get, and kind of figure out the return on investment and whether it's worth it for like how much money you need to put into it. But yeah, I really like the whole like house hacking and then moving every few years thing. I know not everybody wants to move, but honestly, like, real estate's expensive. And when you start trying to invest in like just rental properties, the 20% down payment is really tough for a lot of people to come up with, including us. So being able to put 5% down, live in it for a while, reduce your own living expenses, and then move into another property with another 5% down, and then now cash flow that property as long as the numbers make sense and you can actually do that, is I think a really good strategy to help get ahead and have a little extra cash to put towards your debt or your investments or whatever.
You were okay, totally right, Jordan. So I love number that one. House hacking is one of my favorite
is reducing
not even investment strategies, even more lifestyle strategies. And I would say, especially for young folks who are going to school or just getting those first jobs, a house hack can be anything. Even if we take back to your first condo, if you have a two bedroom condo and you rent out one of the rooms for $600, you've now offset $600 of your expenses in that property. Now there's obviously a little wear and tear and, you know, someone's using a little bit more utilities, but for the most part, that is now just $600 that you're no longer putting towards your expenses. So I have many friends who early on, and I'm so jealous of them, when they were going to school, they bought a house with four or five bedrooms and they rented out those bedrooms to classmates, to friends. You're at an age where this is what you do. You live in lower income rooms or condos, and you have a plethora of people who are looking for these types of properties. So for me, house hacking is a brilliant strategy, because at the beginning, it doesn't necessarily even have to be about does the property cash flow exactly? But even if you can offset your living costs substantially, it's so powerful for young people. And especially if you can just get your foot on the ladder in real estate, it's brilliant. So I love the 2 points there.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I actually been house hacking long before I realized that's what it was, because my parents owned a condo that I lived in when I was a student. And they actually, I asked if I could get roommates. I don't even know why I wanted roommates, but they ended up letting me keep the rent that the roommates were paying me, and I wasn't paying rent. So like, that was crazy. And I was too financially illiterate to do anything smart with that, so I just spent it. But in hindsight, like, for younger people that are in school, do that. Like, if you can buy a place, or like if your parents own it, like, have a roommate. Like, it's social, it's fun. Like, that's the time of your life you're going to want to live with people. And then use that money, put it into investments, save it, do something smart with it, help pay your school costs, whatever, you know, like, help it to get you further ahead financially, and use that to your advantage. I wish I would have been smart enough or known about that back then, but I just spent it on stuff. So,
lastly, just as a quick caveat to that, also treat it like a business. If you are bringing in friends and students, you know, this is, you know, treat it a little bit like, this is non-negotiable. Rent is rent. And then if you reinvest that money, it can have amazing long-term benefits for you. But what do we have last on the list? And I also love this point. One of my favorite on your list.
So drive a used paid for vehicle. I think, like, it's really easy when you, and I've seen this happen to so many people, but it's really easy when you first get your big fancy paycheck, you're out of school, and you're like, oh, now, you know, it's the same thing with me. I was like, I got to have all these nice clothes and a nice apartment. Well, a lot of people are like, I got to go get the fancy vehicle. I remember friends buying like $70,000 vehicles, and I was like, ooh. And I've never been like a car person, so I don't really care. But I know a lot of people really like nice vehicles, and teach their own. Like, where you spend your money is up to you. But I think it's important to realize that, like, you only have so much to go around. And if you're spending a significant portion on a vehicle compared to relative to your income, like, then you're choosing that's what you value. So, like, just make sure you know, like, is that what you value? And is that, like, what your financial goal is right now, is to, like, have a fancy car? And if it's not, then maybe reprioritizing or looking at a different option for vehicles. But yeah, for me, again, I was lucky. My parents really, like, they tried to set me up for success financially, but I think because they did so much and they helped so much and we never talked about it, it almost just kind of, like, kept financial literacy away from me, if that makes sense. Like, it kind of, like, stunted my ability to learn about finances. So they did buy my first car, which I'm really grateful for. And I drove that thing for 7 years, and I would have kept it longer. I loved it. It was like a Volkswagen Tiguan. It was cute and perfect for, like, a new student. But I had a deer and I totaled it off. And the money that we got from SGI, I ended up just, like, putting back into a lesser expensive vehicle. And I've had that thing for like 6 years now. It's been paid off. And I have acknowledged that my parents won't be buying my next vehicle. So I've since started a savings bucket where I'm trying to put about $5,000 a year into a savings account, so that in the next 4, 5, 6 years, when I'm anticipating needing a new vehicle, I will be able to cash flow it myself. So yeah, I think that's an important one. A lot of people end up with a really expensive car payment. Like, if you're paying $700 a month to a car, like, I get it, cars are fun, but, like, they do the same thing. They get you from point A to point B, and they don't appreciate. Like, they depreciate, especially if you're buying a new one, like, the first couple of years, like, so much. So it's best advice is kind of to buy one that's 2 to 3 years old. That was the car that I own now. We bought, I think it was 2 years old, and it had only like 18,000 kilometers on it when I bought it. And it was only like $22,000, which is still enough for a vehicle, but it wasn't like a $40,000, $50,000, or $70,000 vehicle, which is what a lot of people that I know were, like, leasing and financing. So that vehicle's been great. It's been my vehicle costs are low every year. I mean, I pay for some maintenance and gas and, like, insurance, and that's kind of it. So that's been a really good financial decision, and one that I think I will continue to do in the long term. So I can't fathom spending that much on a car and then having the value of it decline so fast.
There are 2 points on the vehicle one. Number one, just like in house hacking, if you have a roommate who's helping pay for your rent, in the same way, if you have the ability to not have a monthly payment on the car, that's money that you can now allocate to other things or have bigger savings. Secondly, car payments can hurt you when you're trying to buy investments or buy real estate due to the high payments correlated with that vehicle. And as you accurately point out, one is going to depreciate and one is most likely to appreciate. And so it really breaks my heart a lot of times when folks come in to get a mortgage and we have a really high car payment that essentially wipes out their ability to buy a home. And so even if they could have, even if they could have found a way to debt service both the car and the house, because the car was purchased first, it takes away the ability for them to buy the property. So I think it's a really prudent point to say, if you can save on vehicle costs, or even better yet, have something where there's no payment at all per month, you're going to be so much more financially ahead than someone who might look on the surface to be much better off than you because they're driving a really nice vehicle. But ultimately, you know, they're really hurting themselves by having that big payment.
Yeah, exactly. And like a lot of financial experts say, like, instead of fixating on like lowering every tiny little cost, like not grabbing your morning coffee or buying avocados or whatever, it's better to focus on like the big things in your budget, which is housing and vehicle costs a lot of the time. So if you can get those things down and under control a little bit more and not spend beyond your means, like you can set yourself up to have a lot of extra cash to put towards other goals. And for me, like I said, it's the financial independence thing that's kind of keeping me and driving me and keeping me being like, okay, it's worth it to not spend on expensive cars right now or to have a basement suite with a tenant in it, like, because I'm getting closer to having freedom and options in my 40s or 50s or whatever in life.
Wonderful. That's so awesome. You're really a great person to chat about this, Jordan. And I really appreciate all you've shared with us today. Just a couple last questions for you. Number one, if you could go back to young Jordan, what advice would you give to her?
Oh gosh. I can't like shame myself for not knowing what I didn't know back then. And like, I think everyone's doing the best that they can with the tools that they have. So I think for one, like, it's okay. And I try not to like hold too much like regret for the choices that I made back then because I just didn't know. I wish that I had more resources or knowledge or like, and my parents did the best that they could too. Like they were young when they had us. They don't know this stuff. They weren't taught it from their parents. It's kind of a generational thing. So going back to myself, like I wish I could teach myself what I know now. I wish I could say like, start saving your money now. Don't get into a bunch of consumer debt. It's not going to make you happier. It's not going to add anything to your life, especially in the long term. Like most of that stuff, I don't even own anymore. And had I started investing and putting my money away and saving towards future goals, I'd be so much further ahead right now. So it's hard to not look back and like feel a little bit of regret for that. But again, I didn't know what I didn't know. So I think for like myself, but also like younger people, like if you're listening to this podcast and you're like going out and like, you know, anything about finances, like you're already in a better place than I was and you already have a head start and that's awesome. And again, like personal finance is personal and people are messy and we're all just human and like nobody's perfect. And so give yourself grace when things aren't going perfectly and you're not able to stick to every single goal or every single thing that you want to hit. But like progress makes, what is it? Like, what's the saying? Practice makes progress. That's the saying. So as long as you're practicing and you're trying and you're making like little tweaks here and there and you're learning, you're making progress. And like, that's all you can ask for yourself. So I don't know.
I don't know if it's the saying, but I think it's also applicable that progress is better than perfection. So,
yeah. You know, I think you can that's the point. It's like progress makes, instead of practice makes perfect, it's practice makes progress. Because you can't get perfection. Nobody's perfect at anything. But as long as you're practicing and you're making progress, like you're getting better, you know, as much as you can. So, yeah, I think, I guess if I had to give advice, it would be like, yeah, go easy on yourself, give yourself some grace, and maybe like try to start investing and putting some of your money away. Because I had so many opportunities. I had no costs. And like all this like income. So I also worked like basically full time serving. So I had a lot of like income and I wish I had known what to do with it back then to set myself up. But I think when you're young also, you think you have so much time. Like when I was like 19, 20, I was like, oh my gosh, like I don't need to start saving for a house. Like I'm not going to buy that till I'm like 30. And it's like, well, once you're 26, 27, you realize it takes a lot longer to save up like a 20% down payment than 2 or 3 years. So I think also like young people, you don't often think like, oh, I need to plan out my future and I need to start saving for retirement and things like that. But time is like your biggest tool. And when you're young, you have so much more time. And so like, if I could go back 10 years ago and tell myself, like, you have time on your hands, like I still have time on my hands. I'm only 30 or 31 now, but like you have even more time to get started and you know, set yourself up for success when you're young. So I think that's the best time to start if you can.
Well said. Jordan, if someone wants to get in contact with you, if they want to follow along, if they have a question for you, just let us know what you got going on and where people can find you.
Yeah. I don't really do like a whole lot of like, I don't sell courses or anything like that at the moment. Maybe down the road I'd like to, but right now I just have an Instagram page. It's Aligned Finances. If you want to follow me, I just share kind of a lot of my own personal stuff. I think financial transparency is something that I lacked a lot when I was younger. And had I been able to see how other people were doing things, or like, I just feel like finances is such a taboo topic and it's scary to share and it's scary to like to talk about, I guess. But that's something that I think younger me could have really benefited from. And I think being transparent and vulnerable and open allows other people to do the same. And so I share a lot of my own stuff on there. And then I share some stuff that I've learned and some tips and tricks and things like that. So if you want to follow me on Instagram, you can follow me there. I also have a link in my bio to book a one-on-one session if you are interested in talking about anything personal finance, real estate. If there's any way that you think I can give you advice or help you with anything, I have given a lot of advice, a lot of it free in the past, to friends, family, acquaintances, to kind of figure out what their goals are and where they should be putting their money. So yeah, I guess that's where you can find me if you want to follow.
Brilliant. In the short time that I followed you, Jordan, I've found there's a tremendous amount of value in your Instagram. So I would highly recommend to go and give you a follow and follow along as you continue on your journey here. Thank you so much for coming on today and sharing and being open about your awesome financial journey, and continued good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was really nice.